Today is Friday, January 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. The top U.S. diplomat holds talks with his Russian counterpart.
We don't expect to resolve our differences here today, but I do hope and expect that we can test whether the path of diplomacy, of dialogue, remains open.
The head of U.S. Africa Command says threats are growing in Africa.
So who's in Somalia every day is less than 100.
And COVID cases are down in Africa. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken held what he calls critical talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Geneva Friday as fears escalate over a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Going into the meeting, the two men said they did not expect any breakthroughs. Blinken has warned that the U.S. and its allies' response would be swift if Russia did invade Ukraine. In Geneva Friday, Lavrov denied Russia has any plans to do that.
Устами своих официальных представителей.
Lavrov says Russia has never, not a single time, threatened Ukrainian people through its official spokespersons. He goes on to say that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been encouraged by Western governments to do whatever he wants and has publicly stated that if some Ukrainian citizens feel they're Russian, they can leave Ukraine and go to Russia. Blinken told reporters in Geneva that the talks were a discussion, not a negotiation. Still, Blinken says he continues to hope to resolve the standoff diplomatically.
This is a critical moment. You're right. We don't expect to resolve our differences here today, but I do hope and expect that we can test whether the path of diplomacy, of dialogue, remains open. We're committed to walking that path and to resolving our differences peacefully, and I hope we can test that proposition today.
100,000 Russian troops remain massed along the Ukraine border, and tensions remain high. U.S. President Joe Biden has sought to clear up any misunderstanding surrounding remarks made on Wednesday, saying he has made very clear to Russian President Vladimir Putin that any movement of Russian troops across Ukraine's border will be treated as an invasion and will trigger severe consequences. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
With Ukraine bracing for a potential Russian invasion, U.S. President Joe Biden said Thursday his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, is fully aware of the consequences. U.S. President Joe Biden.
I've been absolutely clear with President Putin. He has no misunderstanding. If any assembled Russian units move across the Ukrainian border, that is an invasion. But it will be met with severe and coordinated economic response that I've discussed in detail with our allies, as well as laid out very clearly for President Putin.
Biden raised eyebrows the day before during a White House press conference when he said a minor incursion by Russia into Ukraine could trigger a debate among NATO allies on how to respond. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky took to Twitter to respond to Biden's original remark, saying there are no small nations and no minor incursions. German Marshall Fund's Michael Kimmage told VOA he does not consider Biden's impromptu remark to be damaging because the U.S. leader's overall message to Putin has been very clear. Michael Kimmage is with the German Marshall Fund.
But I think what Biden was trying to say, President Biden was trying to say, is that there's going to be a graduated response calibrated to the severity of a Russian move, which, you know, I think boils down to common sense.
In Berlin, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Germany's foreign minister and outlined the high stakes surrounding a possible Russian invasion during a speech Thursday. The top U.S. diplomat said a Russian invasion would violate long-held principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity, triggering a major land war in Europe that would likely leave tens of thousands of people dead. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
To allow Russia to violate those principles with impunity would drag us all back to a much more dangerous and unstable time, when this continent and this city were divided in two, separated by no man's lands, patrolled by soldiers with the threat of all-out war hanging over everyone's heads. It would also send a message to others around the world that these principles are expendable, and that too would have catastrophic results.
Blinken started his diplomatic tour in Kyiv, meeting with Ukraine's president on Wednesday, and travels from Berlin to Geneva to meet with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Friday. While the West has rejected Russia's demand for a guarantee that Ukraine will never join NATO, analysts say there are plenty of security issues to be discussed. William Taylor is with the United States Institute of Peace and is a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine.
So there are some things that are not on the table, but there are some things like missile deployments in Europe, like military exercises. Again, on both sides, missile deployments in NATO, missile deployments in Russia, military exercises by NATO, military exercises by Russia. Those kind of things can be discussed. And if President Putin wants to climb down, look for a nonviolent way out, this is on the table.
With Russia releasing video of its forces conducting drills near the Ukraine border, experts say Moscow would likely come to regret an invasion, which could turn into a long, costly war. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The head of the U.S. Africa Command says security threats are growing across the continent. In his first on-camera interview since taking command 2 years ago, General Stephen Townsend spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb about his increasing concerns, including the spread of violent extremist groups, the role of Russian mercenaries, military inroads by China, and threats from Iran.
The U.S. military has now confirmed reports that Russian mercenaries known as the Wagner Group are in Mali. General Stephen Townsend, the commander of U.S. Africa Command, told VOA Thursday that Mali's junta brought in hundreds of foreign fighters to protect their regime.
Wagner is in Mali. They are there, we think, in numbering several hundred now. They're deploying there, supported by the Russian military. Russian Air Force airplanes are delivering them. The world can see this happening. So it's a great concern to us. And the reason it concerns me and it concerns the neighbors there is we have watched Wagner, this mercenary outfit, work on the African continent. We've watched them in the Central African Republic, Sudan, Libya. They don't follow anybody's rules but their own. They will exploit the country. They will create, they will break laws. They will do gross violations of human rights. They will kill innocents and civilians. And then when the Malian people get tired of them, they won't leave.
Townsend, who took over U.S. Africa Command in 2019, also told VOA the most active global competitor in Africa is not Russia, but China. Beijing, he says, is following billions of dollars of economic investments on the continent with creeping, steady, and strategic military investments. In 2017, China's military opened up a base in Djibouti just a few kilometers away from Camp Lemonnier, the United States' only military base in Africa. The general said Beijing now looks to Africa's western coast, intent on building a military airbase or naval facility in Equatorial Guinea.
They're putting chips down in all these countries on the Atlantic coast. They know that they won't get a yes in many cases from many of those countries. But by asking and trying to get a base in all these countries, one or two of them may say yes. And we think that the place that they've got traction right now is Equatorial Guinea. We're not asking them to choose between China and us. What we're asking them to do is consider their other international partners and their concerns, because a Chinese military base in Equatorial Guinea is of great concern to the U.S. and all of their other partners.
In addition to Chinese military expansion, Townsend said he's monitoring a less obvious threat to U.S. interest on the continent, the one from Iran.
We are starting to see them express increasing interest in Africa and starting to make some inroads there. I think their inroads are going to be malign in nature. And so we're just keeping an eye on it. It's very nascent. But it's happening now, and we're watching it.
Can you give us any examples? Can you get into a couple of examples of that?
I'll just say that they're intelligence-related, and they're the arm of the Iranian security apparatus that engages in malign activity in the Middle East is the same arm that's now engaged on the African continent.
A U.S. official confirmed to VOA that after a U.S. drone strike killed Iran's elite Quds Force leader Qasem Soleimani, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps plotted assassination attempts on American diplomats in Africa and is still looking for revenge targets there. Iran has dismissed the accusations as baseless. Due to concerns over increased threats, officials say in the past year, the U.S. military has brought in new and improved defense systems and anti-drone weapons to Camp Lemonnier. The Pentagon has just completed a global posture review of U.S. forces and military resources around the world, a review that Townsend says, quote, ratified AFRICOM's current posture. The command did, however, lose some funding for military exercises with African partners. And for the last year, Townsend says he has shuttled troops in and out of Somalia. Donald Trump ordered most of the 800 U.S. troops out of the war-torn country in 2020 in one of his last foreign policy moves as American president.
They are in bases in the region, and we commute to work. And so who's in Somalia every day is less than 100.
How's that affecting the mission?
We are working hard to get our tasks done. I think that there's more effective and efficient ways to do that. We provided those recommendations to the Secretary of Defense, and we're waiting for decisions there.
But as Townsend awaits decisions from the Pentagon, political infighting continues in Mogadishu, where al-Qaeda affiliate al-Shabaab is adding to its ranks.
The threat of al-Shabaab is growing, and if increased pressure is not applied to al-Shabaab, I'm concerned that there's going to be a significant al-Shabaab attack. We've seen just suicide bombs going off in Mogadishu over the last 2 weeks. So I think they're expanding and they're a growing threat.
The January 12th attack on the Somali capital killed at least 8 people. Carla Babb, VOA News.
President Joe Biden says there is some progress being made after 8 rounds of talks between Iran and 6 major world powers over the country's nuclear ambitions. But a prominent member of that group, Russia, has been holding its own discussions with Iran's leadership. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House on what the future might hold for these sensitive negotiations.
Major world powers have spent months holding delicate talks with Iran in hopes of resurrecting the 2015 agreement to curb Tehran's nuclear weapons program. The agreement was ruptured in 2018 when former President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the deal. The 6 nations who entered the pact, known as the P5+1, have allowed Washington and Tehran to speak indirectly since President Joe Biden resolved to rejoin the agreement last year. In 2019, Iran began to incrementally violate the restrictions, alarming the West. The 8th round of talks ended this month without significant progress, but Biden said he's optimistic.
It's not time to give up. There is some progress being made. The P5+1 is on the same page, but it remains to be seen.
But are the members in agreement? As Biden spoke, Russia, another member of the group, met separately with Iranian officials. On Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted Iran's president, who appeared to say the 6 parties may not be entirely in lockstep.
We are in a unique situation that has created considerable cooperation between the 2 countries against the West's unilateralism and American power.
Those who have been watching Iran closely say there may be reason for hope. Robert Lifuck is Senior Vice President and Director of International Security Studies at the Wilson Center think tank.
I think the basis for President Biden's assessment is that analytically, a deal is evident. And that deal would entail Iran coming back into compliance with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear agreement in return for sanctions relief and an extension of the sunset provisions that would have ended the constraints on Iran's uranium enrichment program. So analytically, you can see the structure of a deal. But the question is whether there's political space in Tehran to seal the deal.
VOA asked White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki to shed light on why Biden is optimistic.
We're in the diplomatic negotiations, and we've been very clear about where we stand on what we would agree to. But again, I don't have anything to read out for you beyond the status of where they are now.
Could this escalate? Litvak says there may be a third path.
If diplomacy fails and there are major constraints on the use of force, the third alternative is America's traditional default strategy toward adversarial states, which is containment and deterrence. And that strategy worked against Stalin's Soviet Union, Mao's China, and the Kim family's North Korea. The proponents of the military option should diplomacy fail are arguing that Iran's regime is uniquely dangerous and irrational. And that assessment runs up against the national intelligence estimate by the intelligence community, which argued that Iran operates according to a cost-benefit analysis.
So could a breakthrough happen now after 8 rounds? Maybe. On Thursday, Iran's president told Russian lawmakers the regime is not seeking nuclear weapons and is serious in reaching an agreement, if the other parties are serious in real and effective removal of the sanctions. Anita Powell, VOA News, at the White House.
A new World Health Organization report says weekly COVID-19 cases across Africa have dropped significantly, and the number of deaths fell for the first time since the peak of the fourth Omicron-related COVID wave. The latest surge in cases lasted 56 days. WHO's regional office in Africa says newly reported cases fell by 20% last week. I asked Dr. Nonso Agiofo, team leader for health operations in the WHO regional office for Africa, what factors might have contributed to the drop in COVID cases.
These are the outputs of some of the efforts that have been put in place by health workers, but also by governments of member states in Africa. To start with, we have been able to establish a good surveillance system that is able to pick up spiking cases and enables us to inform decision in quickly demobilizing to hotspot areas. For some time now, we've been able to categorize our countries into countries in resurgence, and we have, based on expressed country needs, been able to establish measures to support those countries to tackle cases. So I think some of these are what is playing out in the decreasing numbers that you see.
What can you tell us about what's happening in South Africa in particular, where the Omicron variant was first sequenced?
What is happening in Africa is a reflection of what is happening, I'll say, across the region. And what we have seen across the region is that cumulatively, numbers in new cases reporting have continued to decline in the last 4 weeks. The report we presented in the morning shared there has been a decline in 20% in the week of 16th January, and the same translates as well to death decreasing by 8%. So the South African picture is a reflection of the regional picture that we are seeing in Africa.
And are there countries in Africa where the Omicron-related type of COVID cases are still surging?
Yes. There are countries in Africa that are still reporting, largely in the northern part of Africa. But cumulative average, what we are seeing is, in totality, a decline in number of cases.
Africa has seen a lower number of cases just broadly in general, that lower than what many health experts had expected, since many of the countries, they're not wealthy countries. They don't have the resources to send vaccines out to everyone. They don't have the transportation or the programs, the staffing. So why do you think that is, that it was lower than expected overall with this pandemic?
Well, I think that it will be expecting really less of Africa to say that due to these limitations, we are not expected to do as well as we are doing in vaccine. But suffice it to say that it's in realization of some of these limitations that are within the environment that are peculiar to Africa that public health experts across board, and I'm not just speaking for WHO, have been able to work out strategies that help mitigate. There are best practices here. There are, you know, technology-aided innovations that are coming out of Africa, use of drones to deliver medicines, vaccines. I give it to the healthcare workers in Africa. I think they've been able to appreciate the peculiarity of our environment to the extent of, you know, fashioning out strategies that are working. And this is demonstrated by the numbers that we are seeing.
That is Dr. Nonso Agiofo, the team leader for health operations in the WHO Regional Office for Africa. He was speaking to me from Brazzaville in the Republic of the Congo on Thursday. In eastern Iraq, authorities say 11 soldiers were killed in an overnight attack by the Islamic State militant group at a military base. The extremist Sunni group took over swaths of Iraq and neighboring Syria in 2014, declaring itself a new caliphate for Muslims before Baghdad declared victory in late 2017. But a low-level insurgency by the jihadists has persisted, flaring up in various areas, especially in rural spots north of Baghdad, around the city of Kirkuk, and in eastern provinces. In Bangladesh, families of victims of forced disappearances allegedly perpetrated by an elite Bangladeshi military group Friday called on the UN to ban the security force from serving as peacekeepers. The appeal was made a day after 12 international rights groups, including Amnesty International, made similar demands to the UN Department of Peace Operations. A new study says more than 1.2 million people are dying every year from bacterial infections that are resistant to antibiotics. That makes multi-resistant bacteria far deadlier than HIV/AIDS or malaria, Henry Ridgewell reports.
Over 1.2 million people are dying every year from bacterial infections that are resistant to antibiotics, according to a new study. That makes multi-resistant bacteria far deadlier than HIV/AIDS or malaria, Henry Ridgewell reports. Typhoid fever is a growing problem in many developing countries, including in Pakistan, fueled by a strain of the bacterium that is resistant to antibiotics. It can cause a high fever, diarrhea, vomiting, and death. A recent study in Nairobi revealed a dramatic increase in drug-resistant strains. It is just one example of a disease that is making a comeback. The largest multinational study of its kind shows that across the world, an estimated 1.27 million people died directly from infections caused by bacteria resistant to multiple antibiotics.
It is estimated that if we don't find alternatives by 2050, millions of lives will be lost and there will be $100 trillion lost output.
The study, published in The Lancet and led by the University of Washington, analyzed data from 204 countries. Poorer nations are worst hit by antibiotic resistance, especially sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. Most deaths were caused by respiratory or blood infections. Scientists say the misuse of antibiotics over decades has encouraged microorganisms to evolve into superbugs. Again, Dr. Antonia Sagona.
For example, people have viral infections and they were, have been prescribed antibiotics for very many years now. And these over the years has made the problem very severe. So the bacteria have become really resistant to these antibiotics.
The World Health Organization has warned that none of the 43 antibiotics in development or recently approved were enough to combat antimicrobial resistance. So what can be done? Sagona, along with scientists around the world, are working on new treatments called phages. Again, Dr. Antonia Sagona.
These are viruses that can specifically target bacteria and they can be used in combination with antibiotics or on their own to clear bacterial infections of multi-resistant strains.
Despite the promising new treatments, scientists say it's vital that existing antibiotics are not overused to help slow down the development of the ever deadlier superbugs. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of Managing Editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thanks for being here. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.